Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. I call listeners to this podcast Everyday Innovators. That means something. We are wired in such a way that makes us curious about problems people have. But we don't stop there. Our real curiosity is how we can develop a product or enhance a product that solves a problem and creates value for customers. This is the world of product managers and innovators. And as an everyday innovator, you are part of this world. Now, some everyday innovators have emailed me rather recently asking to discuss tools for product managers. There's a lot of ways to think about tools, such as the innovation tools that Evan Shelsher talked about back in episode 113, not that long ago. But a common request is software tools for product managers, and that is what this episode is about. To help me, I found a company that maintains a list of software tools they use in their own work. They also add to this list other tools that could be used. In all, that list contains 87 tools and is growing. To discuss what is on the list, I spoke with Shah Ahmed, a project manager at the company, which is Indicative, a behavioral data analytics company. Shah works on developing products and manages implementations of their platform. Previously, he has been a management consultant for Deloitte, focusing on large-scale technology changes for Fortune 500 companies. His interest in building products started when he worked at a startup incubator at Cornell University during his undergraduate days. If you've been wanting to hear about product management software tools, now is the time. See the summary of the discussion and more valuable information in the show notes at theeverydayinnovator.com/118. Shah, thanks so much for joining the Everyday Innovator podcast.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So this came about in part because one of the questions I'm frequently asked of, you know, from other product managers, people wanting to get into product management, are what are tools available for product managers? What tools do product managers use? There's different ways we can get to this, but you guys developed, your company developed this really great blog post that has to do with tools, and it's titled The 87 Most Essential Tools for Data-Driven Product Management. So let's start first with the context there. What is data-driven product management?
Sure. So whenever I sort of hear the question, you know, what is data-driven product management, I almost start off by talking about what isn't data-driven product management. And I fall into that trap more often than I care to admit, but it tends to be, you know, what does product manager look like without using data decisions? It tends to be product managers using either their gut or explicitly just using customer interviews. Uh-huh. And just using those two, you fall into the trap of just using your gut. It tends to be unfounded. You spend a full development lifecycle, and we tend to be surprised when there's no traction. We've never validated our demand, so it's tough. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you just use customer interviews, you strictly use customer interviews, you can fall into the trap where there could be a vocal minority, or realistically, a lot of customers don't realize that sometimes what they ask for doesn't meet their core use case. So we can unpack that as we go. But in summary, data-driven product management is, how do I get rid of some of these preconceived notions? How do I test my hypothesis very early on? And realistically, any product decision should be able to be informed by use of data. And for us, we tend to break our data into three big groups. General usage data, information of how users and customers go between certain features of our product. Mm-hmm. And three, and sometimes more importantly, it's retention or stickiness. When something is released, how often do they come back? Or if a product is released, is it just a one-time thing, or are people returning to use that product? Uh-huh. And but realistically, all that information drives our data-driven product roadmap. And that tends to be the biggest filter or the biggest top-level analysis of where data is dealt with in decision-making. So when we are doing our data-driven roadmap, realistically, at least at Indicative, we bucket all our feature ideas or iterative designs in five large buckets. It tends to be new ideas or enhancements that haven't been created. Two is the iterations of older product ideas we've had. Three is very, very common customer problems. Four is how do we improve usability or just quality of our product? Basically sort of maturity there. And then finally, we either we do scaling and optimizations for technical or functionality. And all five of them sort of have their spectrum of what's possible to be data-driven. And on the far left, we have new ideas and functionality. It's a little tougher to be data-driven in that we don't have immediate feedback on what's going to be the future. And, you know, it basically becomes innovator's dilemma as far as, is this going to be a great feature or not? That tends to be a little more organic and we're testing hypotheses. But on the other hand, common customer problems, that's easily quantifiable. As you know, if you're using Zendesk or some help desk solution, you can almost sum up how many times a feature has been quoted as an issue or needed to be worked on. Mm-hmm. And then again, we think about improving quality or usability, what areas of your product are not even touched. You know, most tools will tell you, group by feature and tell me what's used, what's not used. So our data-driven roadmap, you know, there's a gradient. What can be data-driven? And we try our best to make sure it is data-driven. But still, you need some product manager intuition to make sure you can try your best to be strategic in the future.
Sure. There's always an important sanity check. And I have heard discussions about, you know, data-driven test cases where we're trying to evaluate option A or option B, where we should have stepped back in the first place and realized that these two don't even make sense to begin with, right? So there's that sanity check. Yeah. So that's some good foundation. And when you talk about indicative in the company that you do this work for, it's a software context. I do want to point out that even though we'll be talking about, you know, that software context, a lot of these tools apply to all kinds of product management domains. Some of these tools are specific for getting information about users and tracking that. Others are just management. You know, how do you keep track of data and information, right? So really useful. Give us the brief background on how this list came about, your list of 87 most essential tools. Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting story where this management tool actually, or this list of tools was actually around way before I was actually part of Indicative. Mm-hmm. And when it was initially created, it was our original marketing team, which at that time was also our product team and every other team because it was much smaller. And at that point in time, we were iterating on our development lifecycle. We were trying new tools. And internally, we were building a list of things we liked, what worked for us. And we figured this is very useful to share. And as we did that, we realized, the marketing team realized, you know, our core demographic, our core customer is product managers and marketers. This would be a great list for other product managers. Mm-hmm. So we publicized it and enhanced the list. And I think it was almost a year ago, the last couple updates were made to the list currently.
And that is the nice thing about the list is that it's not static. You do add new tools at times to it. And it is broken out into 11 categories. We don't have time to go through all 87 tools, as much fun as that would be. But I am hoping we can hit the categories just so people at least have an idea of what kind of tools are available. And certainly I will link to the original blog post on the show notes for this episode. But let's get started and talk through some of these areas. And the first one up is mind mapping. Mm-hmm. Tell us what mind mapping is and then a tool that you like to use.
Yep. Generally, especially at Indicative, we tend to use mind mapping tools specifically to group our thought processes, group some concepts. You know, we talked earlier about the five types of products we like to roadmap. So we'll tend to group even our ideas for future enhancements that are strategic, customer problems that we know of. To me, this just might be my opinion, but it's almost using mind mapping tools for posterity of whiteboarding sessions. I think the crux of it is a whiteboarding session. We always whiteboard our ideas, we whiteboard the concepts, the future of Indicative, but for posterity or for collaboration, we'll tend to use a mind mapping tool. We don't use mind mapping tools as often as we used to. It tends to be more of really just whiteboarding sessions.
So with that, for whiteboarding sessions, you know, if you're developing a product, you have to have a whiteboard around. Most of us have lots of whiteboards around. So, and for those that aren't used to at all what a mind map is, I typically think of it, you know, you start, if you're doing on a whiteboard with the main problem or activity in the middle, and then you just start drawing out, you know, radials out from this, kind of like spokes on a wheel, and different ideas. And some people who have artistic talent really make these visual, right? And go crazy with that. Are you using, to capture information, I'm just curious, are you using, you know, standard whiteboards, or have you moved to digital whiteboards that are also capturing some of this for you?
We still use traditional whiteboards, and we have basically every one of our rooms is whiteboarded wall or whiteboarded movable whiteboards.
Yep.
And to kind of add on to what you're describing, it's good for ideation in the early process of product development. But I personally use mind mapping myself, and others use mind mapping to almost realistically really map your mind in that, you know, trunks of knowledge for, you know, even for resources. Me personally, as a product manager, what are my trunks of knowledge and what expertise do I have? So, you know, I'll have infrastructure knowledge, CS knowledge, product management. It almost helps me decide, what am I good at? What am I not good at? What should I reach out for help for? So it's a very flexible tool. Mind mapping is a flexible tool.
Great. And you have 14 on your list for people who can go investigate. Let's move on to the next category, and that's flowcharts and diagrams. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, and I don't know if there's a specific tool there that you like to use too.
Yeah, so for flowcharts we use for basically process design. So I come from a management consultant background where I was knee deep in process design and flowcharts for several years. And my experience has been in proprietary tools that are used with very, very strict business guidelines. But the types of processes that I used to map out tend to be very business process oriented. But as we evolve into, for example, I've joined the startup world for a little over a year now. Mm-hmm. This very specific flow that matters to us is, what is your development lifecycle? Going from ideation all the way to release, what are the gates? What are the checks? What are the cyclical natures that you have? What are the conditional steps? And, you know, if you talk to a product manager or project manager, they can tell you offhand what it is. But what's more important is, who are the decision makers at certain steps? What are the gates, the reviews, and how do you map that all out? At the end of the day, you want to abstract away decision making and not spend too much time, I'll use the word arguing, over certain areas when you don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly useful for getting our hands around the flow of information and the decisions that are made. Mm-hmm. The two tools that I have used aren't on your list. I've used some of those. But, you know, the tools that aren't actually made for what they're used for often comes up. And so my category, it's PowerPoint and similar, Visio, because you can draw flowcharts.
Yep. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I, for one, love tools that are very, very flexible. And PowerPoint tends to be the most flexible tool available. And I used to be very ingrained in the Microsoft world. So both Visio and PowerPoint were actively used in management consulting. But again, we'll go through it in the other tools. But realistically, if you are building a very, very quick iteration, very, very quick prototype or validation, you could probably use PowerPoint for all of these. As you grow or as you have a larger team, you'll probably want to shy away from that. But I have, you know, weekend projects where I will do my prototype, my mockups, and my process flows and ideation all in PowerPoint. And then I spit that out in a couple hours.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the tool that you know best that can get the job done that's efficient.
Yeah.
Other times it's the tool that's really tailored for that job. That's the one you want to pick.
Yeah.
But when it comes to learning a new tool, sometimes that just takes too long for what we need to accomplish.
It's true. So, and of the list, the one I've used, and you know, I do have a penchant for free tools and the ones that you can pick up immediately. So Draw.io is actually on this list, is a completely free tool. I've actually used that for my personal use, and we used Indicative a little earlier on. But really, it's just, you know, how do you map processes? How do you create conditional steps in a easy to read fashion? At the end of the day, you want to take a very, very, you know, it tends to be what a complex process looks like. Can you boil it down so it's readable and you can onboard other users or members of your team?
Yep. Good. Next up is user research.
If you want to validate a idea or hypothesis very quickly and you have a prototype, you can use one of these tools to get users to get feedback immediately. And one that was used in the past and one that's recommended by my colleagues is Ethnio. It's easy to use, and it's not as expensive as the others.
Two good combinations. If it solves the job, solves the problem, and is less expensive and easy to use, great. So that one is Ethnio. And of course, details about that are on are in the list, and I'll provide a link to that. Mm-hmm. And lots of things we could do for user research, and we could spend all our time talking about that. But I'm going to move on to our next topic, which is road mapping. And you mentioned this one in the beginning that you drive there at your company everything into a roadmap to really as a collaboration, a communication tool. Mm-hmm. Tell us about road mapping.
Yeah, so we talked about it earlier. Roadmaps to me tend to be the distillation of what's going to happen in the and there's some variability of how broad roadmaps are for certain companies. I tend to find roadmaps that go farther than 6 months tend to be a little tough to manage. They tend to, especially in a startup world where the velocity of the iteration cycle is very tight. It's even tough to forecast anything more than 3 to 6 months. But for us, roadmaps. Roadmaps do realistically three things. They order the work you want to do. They put them in a timeline and a list. They distill what you want to do, when you want to do it. But the tough part is deciding why you want to do parts of your roadmap. So why are pieces above others? And that's what needs to be data driven. And, we talked about the five groups earlier that, new features versus iterations versus customer problems. One, you can use data to drive those decisions. But at some point you still need to make a call. You need to make a prioritization decision to say, do I value customer problems above a new feature or iteration? You can continue to quantify that. And we try our best to do that, where we'll build a spreadsheet or a document that says, here is my value criteria. And it helps decision making in that way.
And a couple of these, I've had the CEOs as previous guests, Product Plan mm-hmm. as well as RoadMonk, important tools. And again, like you said, we could use PowerPoint for this. A lot of people do yeah. do that. But the benefit yeah. here is making sure we know where the latest version is. And it's mm-hmm. a much better collaboration tool so people can see what's going on.
Yeah. And again, I for the longest time, bad habits die hard, but I've been Microsoft for a very long time, and I've used Microsoft Project, which is a very powerful tool, but it's geared towards larger enterprises. And then I found that no one else uses Microsoft Project on my team, so I figured I'm going to have to switch it up. Right. Again, you pointed out Product Plan, which is a great tool, and we've actually started trying Dapulse recently, DAPULSE, which is a smaller company, but they have a very powerful road mapping tool. We'll probably add that to this list here.
Good. Yeah. That's great that you guys get some experience with these tools and then add them to the list when they're deemed useful enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Next category is wireframing. What's mm-hmm. the context for wireframing and what's a tool you like?
Wireframing is for us, you go from ideation to requirements gathering. And at the point of requirements gathering, we tend to have a wireframe immediately after where we determine where in our tool certain UI, UX elements go. And wireframing is, for me, I make wireframes that are almost black and white. And it really is just how will it look in the future without any frills, just no color. How does it integrate with your current tool? Uh-huh. And in the past, I've been very partial to Balsamiq. It's very easy to use. And again, we've talked about PowerPoint. I know PMs who still use PowerPoint who have used Excel to build their wireframes because at the end of the day, especially for software, the wireframes just tend to be squares, circles, and rounded rectangles. Uh-huh. The important part is where is it on a page? Where is it in your application? And then the rationale to why is it there or what value does it bring to the page or the elements bring to the application?
Yeah, and Balsamiq is the one I encounter the most when people are using wireframing tools. There's several mm-hmm. there that you list. And I haven't played with Balsamiq for long enough to remember. I don't know if it gives you a pencil mode. I do kind of like the tools that let your wireframes, your mock-ups, look like they were hand-drawn. And the reason for that is because they look like they're meant to be adjusted, right? And you can actually use them. I think they help collaboration and feedback better.
Yeah. And, I've used Balsamiq in the past. And, now at Indicative, we have a design team. So it tends to be a little outsourced to, I'll build almost a wireframe on paper or whiteboards, but it'll be offloaded to a resource to get us a clearer wireframe.
Yep, sure.
But yeah. So again, wireframing, balsamic I've used in the past and I've had a lot of success with it.
Yeah. And for listeners that are yelling at me through the audio here saying, yes, they have that low fidelity sketch kind of look. I just looked it up and indeed they do. So handy to have.
They have a really nice slider where it goes low fidelity or high fidelity where, yeah. You know, they give you that hand-drawn version, but if you flip it to the other side, it's just a clean view of that.
Good. Let's move on to prototyping.
Yeah, and prototyping for us tends to be what is the next step after wireframing? Just a cleaner, high fidelity version of your designs. And historically, I've used InVision for prototyping. It's great for especially for mobile applications where you can almost get a web page that you can save on your homepage for your device that gives you that experience, like a click-through experience of your prototypes. And it lets you test your hypothesis even further where, you know, now you're introducing other design elements that bring you closer to a release product. Mm-hmm. At Indicative right now, our design team actually does their full prototyping in the Adobe suite. So even though we've used, you know, I've used InVision in the past and others have used InVision, as you grow, you tend to just evolve your tools a bit. So our team will use either Photoshop or any other kind of Adobe tool to build layers and build their full prototype before they hand it off to engineers.
Yeah, very useful tools. And if we're out of the software space, you know, we can think of other things like foam and wood and 3D printing and, you know. Yeah. Simple ways of getting physical prototypes too. And then a software tool that lets us do that kind of prototyping, you know, the 3D design tools have become very easy to use and there's online versions and local versions and lots of other options too. So good list of prototyping tools on the site. How about usability testing? This topic comes up more and more with product managers and often we see product teams having a usability person on part of the team. Tell us about usability testing as tools.
Yeah. So again, specifically for a B2B product, we don't have a large customer base as for example, a B2C would have. So you wouldn't be able to say, oh, let's grab X group of people to say if they can use our product. You know, we're specifically looking for product managers, marketers. It's a little tougher to find that exact group of people off the street and say, let's test usability. We tend to do a lot of usability testing with our direct customers. We always have, you know, for us, customer exposure hours is highly correlated with success. So we tend to have, you know, our UI UX member of our team will always have a conversation. We'll have a conversation to say, here is, even at the wireframe or prototype frame step, we'll walk through and have a conversation to say, here's our goal in mind. Here's what we would like to do. Here's a use case that you've brought to us, and here's how we want to solve it. Does this flow seem obvious to you? We'll have that conversation in person. A lot of these tools are good in scaling that, but it depends on the type of product you're building, if that scale is necessary. We love to do, I forget who says it, bench usability testing, where you just work, whoever's next to you, just bring them over. If an engineer's next to you, I'll just say, hey, look at this mock. I want to do X, Y, Z. How do you think we would do it? And we work from there.
Yep. And some of these areas intersect, right? So like, you know, getting user research and turning that into a wireframe and turning that into a prototype and then trying to get some feedback on that through a usability tool. You know, we're trying to get to the end result of, do we understand the problem and do we present a solution that the customer says, yes, that's what I need, right? I'm willing to pay for that.
Yeah.
And so some of these, at least in my mind, they blur together a little bit over time because they're solving different aspects of that validation problem, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And these usability tools listed in the article, a lot of these will let you present a user interface to users and then directly collect their feedback about it and how and give you some information on how well it's performing for them.
That's correct.
Okay. So next up is agile project management. This is a big category. We could spend a lot of time on this
one.
It
is. Yeah. And it's the one that I spend most of my day on. And quite frankly, it's a testy subject. I mean, everyone sort of has their opinions on project management. And the I think the word agile sort of evolves with best practices. Mm-hmm. But specifically for us, at the end of the day, it's how do we get from step A, which is ideation, all the way to the end of release in a tight iteration cycle. And we've historically used quite a few tools, and we've used Trello pretty well, and we like Trello a lot, where we enjoy having appropriate swim lanes and allowing you members to pull from swim lanes at any point in time. But again, I think this is an evolving space, and you know, we try to work with what's best. You know, we use every other tool along with Trello. And the interesting thing is people manage their own workflows. You know, there's a large work path that we work off of. There's a roadmap. We boil it down to basically sprints of features. But at the end of the day, when, you know, engineers, designers, me as a PM, I will manage my own workflow in a special way. I will have maybe my own Trello board off of the larger Trello board. Mm-hmm. And I think that intersection or interlinking of all that work is where it gets complex and interesting.
Right. And Everyday Innovators, if you have not looked at Trello, it's a good free tool to look at, free for some things for it to be used for. It's just a Kanban board put on software, right? And so we're looking at basically columns, and you can make as many columns as you like, and you can move things from a, you know, hasn't started state into a started state, into it needs to be reviewed, whatever you need those columns to do. And talking about tools crossing boundaries, I've seen roadmaps done in Trello also, right, to kind of keep track of what's coming out soon, what's coming out further, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I love the idea of tools evolving and using them for other use cases, because at the end of the day, it's experimentation. What works with your team, what works with your iteration cycle. I would say, you know, if things work, try them. Try them and use them. And if things don't work, validate that hypothesis early on and try something else.
Is there a tool under the Agile project management area that's, you know, geared for what we would consider managing an Agile development team that you have used that you like to go to?
So I've historically used Asana before, and I've used Jira. Quite frankly, Jira tends to be the most robust, and it tends to be, you know, great for the project management, but also bug tracking, mm-hmm. report tracking, and that the full product itself tends to be very, very successful.
Yeah. And I've seen recently there's people that are bolting on product management capabilities to Jira. I just interviewed not too long ago Steve Johnson. He's coming up with a software solution. And Steve Johnson's kind of, you know, he's usually well known in product management circles. That is an add-on to Jira for managing products specifically. So it's probably not a bad one to start with just because of the other organizations and people that are adding capability for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. So we got through that pretty unscathed. There's lots of choices there one can go down. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about A/B testing.
A/B testing basically is, you know, providing a different experience for users and customers and seeing how they react. And, you know, you hear the Silicon Valley stories where every piece of their website has been completely A/B or multivariate testing, and it can be successful. And you have to make the decision of, is it worth the time and effort to multivariate test every piece of your web page, of your application? Historically, I've used Optimizely with success. But again, you know, for Indicative also digests a lot of that A/B testing. Mm-hmm. And being that we work on Indicative, we love to dog food Indicative to do data analytics, and it consumes that A/B testing very nicely. And, you know, Indicative is very powerful for getting time series based behavioral analytics data. And that's basically what we use to drive our roadmap. It tells us what's successful.
Yep. I was just going to mention, for those outside the software space, you might be unaware of this dog food term. And I always love this, right? And I think it originated with Guy Kawasaki, but he may have attributed to someone else. Which is simply, if you're building a product, you should be using it yourself, right? And if you're not, that's suspicious. And it's common in the software industries, at least, to you eat your own, right? You eat your own dog food.
That's exactly right. And our entire roadmap is driven using Indicative. Basically, early on, I was talking about those three broad groups of data, basically general usage data, moving between products and features, basically the customer journey, and finally that retention analysis of if, you know, as features are being used, are people continuing to use it? All three of those are basically indicative analyses, and indicative is a tool that we use for, and it's marketed to be a what's used to drive a data-driven roadmap.
Absolutely. Good. And I want to ask you more about that for sure in a moment. Mm-hmm. We'll get through the list here. The challenging thing with A-B testing is, you know, we have to have enough people trying each of the variations mm-hmm. to start with. And we have to make sure that we change something with purpose and we're not mm-hmm. changing more than one thing, or we understand the relationships. And most of us probably come across this, right? Like sometimes you're on Google and you do a search results and you get search results and go, wow, this looks different. Right. Mm-hmm. And Google sliced off, you know, maybe 0.01% of their audience to serve that different result page to, just to see how people interact with it.
Yeah. And again, you know, we've talked about this earlier where it may differentiate, the differentiating factor may be what type of company you are. Mm-hmm. For example, if you're consumer facing, there's much more lenience in saying, I feel more than okay giving people a different environment or different experience. But as you become more enterprise focused, or if you become more B2B, you have to think about, what am I going to A/B test? Is that going to negatively influence anyone's decision making or processes? So just a notion to think about as you think about multivariate or A/B testing. Mm-hmm.
And the next category comes up also with software products, and especially web-based applications, which mm-hmm. is heat mapping. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that one.
Heat mapping is almost a session tracker in that, you know, everyone sort of knows that everything above the fold tends to have the most focus. But this takes it a step further to say, is that validation or that hypothesis true? You know, one of the key hypotheses that product managers have, especially for mobile applications, is placement of thumb. If it's in the bottom right, you know that's clickable area and that's where people will click. And then the top left tends to be farther reach of the thumb. You know, that could be just product manager intuition, but heat mapping allows you to take that a step further and mm-hmm. validate those hypotheses. For example, it's almost an evolution of A/B testing a bit. It takes it a step further in saying, sure, I put this button in a different area, or I've changed the copy in this area. Is it affecting the way people are moving through the app? Is it affecting the flow between pages, between events on the page?
Okay. Good.
Heat mapping tends to be, and session recording as well, tends to be validation of hypotheses. Have I put things in the right area, or have multiple versions of things been put in the right area? Are features being completely ignored because, one, maybe it's below the fold, maybe it's not visible. Are things that we thought were obvious?
Mm-hmm. Is there a tool on that list that you or the group have used that you enjoy using?
I believe we've used more heat mapping in the past, and I mm-hmm. want to say Clicktail. However, heat mapping we didn't use as often anymore because now that we're more focused on enterprise clients. Again, as you're doing more customer facing products, heat mapping makes more sense. But if your sample size is smaller for different experiences, it tends to be more blips. So you have to make the call: is heat mapping worth it? The cost, if maybe the sample size is not large enough, or the use cases are different.
Right.
So we don't actively use heat mapping, but in other more customer-facing applications, we've seen it been very successful.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, it's a good way on websites to see where people are actually moving their mouse and how long they stay in areas, and mm-hmm. you know what tends to get their attention.
Yeah.
So our final category is analytics. Mm-hmm. Talk about analytics.
Yeah. So you can almost call analytics to be the umbrella for everything else on this list here.
Right.
And on the top of our list, we have Indicative, which is an amazing tool. But basically, it takes everything we've talked about as an umbrella term, and how do you feed it into an overall analytics tool? So specifically, Indicative has three, and also, you know, we'll get into it in a bit, but three large tool bases that solve a very, very particular problem. We focus our tool to product managers and marketers. At the end of the day, we care about conversion rates. We care about broad usage data. We care about retention. So it's great that you have A/B testing. It's great that you've accumulated all this data, but what are you doing with it? How are you driving decisions with it? So, you know, let's say you have an A/B test and you've dumped that data into indicative, and you see people who have an experience with test A versus test B, you see test A being successful. But more importantly, how do I drive larger, more complex queries? The group that's seen A, have they gone through the full application and reached this desired state?
Right.
It takes queries that are non-obvious, and indicative puts it in a way. If you take a look at any of our screenshots, it's a drag and drop tool where you can take any number of events, and events in this case is any user action, mm-hmm. and any number of properties, which is just the context around them, and allows you to ask those questions and get those answers that drive those that decision making. So on this list, I'm going to go ahead and say indicative is the way to go here. And
sure.
The flexibility, the ability to create these complex customer journeys within the tool make it very powerful.
I think we'd be suspicious if you said anything else, actually. So, but this area of analytics is challenging, right? I like the A/B example you gave, because the simple A/B tools, they're looking at, you know, maybe two web pages, and they each have a button on it to take the next action, mm-hmm. right? And the tool tells you that, oh, you know, 53% of the people clicked the button on this page versus 47% of the other page. Hopefully mm-hmm. more meaningful difference, but that's mm-hmm. it. And you need other tools to really put this through to say, well, did we get the conversion that we wanted, right? It could be that the A/B test actually performs best mm-hmm. on the page that results in the lowest conversion.
Yeah.
And it's hard to thread this data together because it often lives in different places. It's for web applications, right? We get some in Google Analytics and we get some in other things we're tracking, and it is hard to consolidate it.
Yeah, and that's why we find indicative to be very powerful, is it allows you to take a lot of that disparate data and put in one place. It allows you to tie all that user action together. We've had such a wide range of customers in different verticals, ranging from subscription paper-based companies to sports companies that provide ticket sales. And being able to tie all that together is immensely important. Mm-hmm. Let's say I've seen a certain advertisement, or I've seen a particular test, or a new feature comes out, how does that affect my behavior? How do I build almost a customer segment to say, this is what I deem to be a upselled or a successful customer. Can I paint a picture of what they look like? And can I query other users who look like that? It allows you to, one, create better target segments, but two, it lets you test hypotheses immensely quicker.
And so listeners know, when you go to this list of 87 tools, I really appreciate how this is laid out, right? You have a little summary of what the tool is, and then you say, who is this best for? What kind of business is this tool best for? Is the learning curve, you know, low, medium, high? Why might you choose this? And then what are the two best features? And that's mm-hmm. true for all the tools, including indicative that you just shared. So that does get us through the 11 categories that the 87 tools are in right now. And obviously we need to go, and I'll provide the link in the show notes for this, indicative.com/essential-tools-product-managers. Is the link. But I know if you search on 87 most essential tools for product management, you will find this.
Yeah. And again, every one of these categories can be its own massive discussion, which we won't have time for, but it really is a good summary. And again, you know, obviously I'm here for indicative, but a lot of this is analytics driven. So everything can be almost intertwined. Again, you know, Chad, you brought up that a lot of tools, the space they fill is not the full space they're useful for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes we use hammers for lots of things that aren't nailing nails into boards.
Yeah.
And I love hearing innovation quotes. And I asked you to bring one also to share with the listeners. What is your quote and why did you choose that one?
Sure. So the quote I chose was by Enrico Fermi, and the quote goes, there are two possible outcomes. If the result confirms the hypothesis, then you've made a measurement. If the result is contrary to the hypothesis, then you've made a discovery. Hmm. And the reason, you know, again, that's definitely not the scope of what he was thinking about. He was clearly thinking about science and hypothesis testing. But that extends so well to product development and product management, where to me, you know, there are two types of failure. One is, you know, if a product is not working and you keep working on that failed idea or that failed version of that idea. The second type is the correct failure, where you've right. iterated correctly. You stopped immediately when you realized this is not the right path. So I think the quote lends itself completely to that idea. It's a very Eric Ries-esque, where the lean startup of fail quickly, come up with your hypotheses, build a version that you can test immediately. And every one of these tools on this list helps you in that process. So that's why I picked it.
Good. It's a great quote. And sometimes we end up with information that we don't like, but it's that contrary information that actually is where the real insights are. And tell us, I want to get a summary from you of Indicative. You know, we talked about it in terms of being an analytics tool a little bit. Leave listeners with the, you know, kind of a soundbite of why we would think about using Indicative.
Yeah, so Indicative is a behavioral analytics tool where you take information about a customer journey, a customer experience, and it's tooled towards optimizing certain paths and understanding, creating queries to get information about your tool or platform. So very specifically, you know, our biggest use case is specifically for product managers and marketers, where if you are proposing a marketing campaign and there's perhaps a very complex journey, let's say you're a major publisher and you have several points of contact with your customer. If a customer has seen certain information or has seen or gone through a certain path, how do I deem that path was successful? Or how do I find out what was the step that had the highest amount of friction? Mm-hmm. Or more importantly, what was very, very successful? What paths are successful? And Indicative allows you in a very simplistic way, allow you to ask those questions. We want to bring the bar lower for we don't want people to build a Python stack to start doing complex analyses and then spit it out to SQL. The goal here is the iteration cycle from asking the business question to getting the information to inform our decision happens in one space and should happen in 5 to 10 minutes, as opposed to coming up with a business question, sharing it to a data science team, having them reach out to a data lake, query it and come back with what they deemed was the correct answer. So we want to close that iteration cycle down. We want to bring down and close the loop of decision making. And Indicative allows you to do that.
Yeah, and it's focused around that customer journey. And this is for any customer journey, right? Not just a software product. Mm-hmm. This is, as you said, publishers. Anyone that is using some kinds of mechanism, which would be everyone, you know, sometimes it's called the sales funnel of how do we contact the customers initially, make them aware of the product, get responses from them. What is that entire journey like?
Yeah, that is exactly right. A customer journey is any journey with multiple steps. And they can be very, Indicative does a very good job of providing insight on nonlinear steps, which is why people tend to use Indicative, is there is no customer journey that is step A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, most companies are omnichannel. They have several ways where customers come in. How do I boil that down and understand it? And that's why people use Indicative.
Shaw, I appreciate you walking through those 11 categories of tools, and we can get more information on all 87 from the blog post. And thanks for taking time talking with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. A lot of everyday innovators email me saying how much they enjoy this podcast, even that it is their favorite one on the topic of product management. I love getting those emails. Please make it easy for other product managers and innovators to find this podcast. And I make that easy for you to do. Just go to the show notes for the summary of the discussion with Shaw, and you'll find links at the top of the page where you can easily share it on your favorite social media sites. Also, from the same page, you can download the Product Mastery Roadmap that shows you how to go from product manager to product master. That and more is at theeverydayinnovator.com/118. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.